Hello and welcome to another episode of the Critical Care Revision Aid Podcast, Episode 2, Subarachnoid Hemorrhage.
How might a patient with subarachnoid hemorrhage present?
The classical presentation of subarachnoid hemorrhage is with a sudden onset severe headache, often described as a thunderclap headache. Other features might include nausea and vomiting, meningism, altered conscious level, seizures, or focal neurological signs.
Can you outline the causes of subarachnoid hemorrhage?
Subarachnoid hemorrhage is most commonly caused by rupture of an intracranial aneurysm, about 80 to 85% of the time. Other causes include intracranial arteriovenous malformations, trauma, and rarely Moyamoya disease, where there is intimal proliferation within the cerebral arteries. Risk factors include hypertension, age, with a peak incidence between 40 and 60 years, male gender, smoking, and cocaine use. There are some inherited conditions associated with aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage. These include autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease, Ehlers-Danlos type 4, neurofibromatosis, and Marfan's.
Where are aneurysms typically located?
Aneurysms are typically located at bifurcations of the circle of Willis. The most common sites for rupture are in the anterior cerebral artery, anterior communicating artery bifurcation, about 40%, and the posterior cerebral artery, internal carotid artery takeoff.
How is subarachnoid hemorrhage diagnosed?
It is diagnosed by history, examination, and investigations. Features in the history are as described previously. Examination features might include decreased conscious level, photophobia or neck stiffness, focal neurology or signs of raised intracranial pressure. The first line investigation is a non-contrast CT head. This is highly sensitive in identifying subarachnoid blood, as well as potential early complications such as hydrocephalus. CT is extremely sensitive when performed within the first 12 hours, but sensitivity rapidly declines after 5 days. If the initial CT is positive for subarachnoid hemorrhage, this will usually be followed by a CT angiogram to identify and locate intracranial aneurysms or AVMs. If this is inconclusive, alternatives include digital subtraction angiogram and MRI. If a CT is non-diagnostic and there's a high clinical suspicion for subarachnoid hemorrhage, an LP should be performed at least 12 hours after symptom onset and the CSF sent for xanthochromia.
Tell me about the scoring systems used for subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Scoring systems can be divided into clinical scoring systems and radiological scoring systems. Examples of clinical scoring systems include the World Federation of Neurosurgeons Scale, or WFNS, and the Hunt and Hess scale. The WFNS scale uses GCS and the presence or absence of motor deficit to grade subarachnoid hemorrhage from 1 to 5, with 1 being GCS 15 and 5 being the worst, with GCS of less than or equal to 6. Hunt and Hess also grades from 1 to 5 based on conscious level and neurological symptoms. An example of a radiological grading system would be the Fisher scale. This grades from 1 to 4, with 1 being no blood seen on CT and 4 being diffuse or non-subarachnoid blood, intracerebral clots or intraventricular involvement.
What are the options for securing the aneurysm? Do you know of any evidence surrounding this?
There are two main options for securing the aneurysm: endovascular coiling and surgical clipping. The ISAT trial randomised patients to coiling or clipping and found that the primary outcome of death or dependence at 1 year was less common in the coiling group. However, long-term follow-up found that patients managed with coiling had a higher incidence of rebleeding and an increased need for further treatment. Despite this, coiling remains the first choice method for securing aneurysms. If aneurysms are not suitable for coiling, for example due to an MCA location or having a wide neck, they may be treated with clipping instead.
How would you manage a patient admitted to ICU with a subarachnoid hemorrhage?
The management of a patient with subarachnoid hemorrhage should follow an ABCDE approach. Priorities include securing the airway where indicated, controlling ventilation, and cautious arterial pressure management, with the aim of minimising the risk of rebleeding while also optimising cerebral perfusion and reducing secondary brain injury. Close liaison with neurosurgery is required. Some indications for intubation include a GCS of less than 8 or a drop of greater than 2 points. For control of ventilation, seizures, uncontrolled hypertension, or to facilitate transfer to a neurosurgical centre. We would take, rather than tying the tube, and nurse the patient with their head in a neutral position and 30 degrees head up. Mechanical ventilation should be targeted to a PaO2 of greater than 10 and a PCO2 of 4.5 to 5. Blood pressure management can be challenging, balancing the optimisation of cerebral perfusion with the risk of rebleeding from an unsecured aneurysm. Systolic blood pressure should be maintained greater than 100 or MAP greater than 80 with fluids and or vasopressors. Until the aneurysm is secured, systolic blood pressure less than 160 or a MAP less than 110 should be targeted, and antihypertensives may be required, with beta blockers being first line.
What neurological complications would you look out for, and how would you manage these?
The main neurological complications are rebleeding, hydrocephalus, seizures and vasospasm with delayed cerebral ischemia. The risk of rebleeding is highest immediately after the initial hemorrhage, with rates of 5 to 10% in the first 72 hours. Prevention centres around avoiding large fluctuations in arterial blood pressure and ICP, as well as securing the aneurysm. Hydrocephalus also usually develops within the first 3 days, but can be delayed. It should be suspected when there is an acute drop in GCS and prompt a repeat CT scan. It's usually treated with the insertion of an extraventricular drain. Seizures are more uncommon, developing up to about 7% of patients. If they occur, they should be treated aggressively, but routine seizure prophylaxis is not recommended.
Tell me more about vasospasm and delayed cerebral ischemia.
Delayed cerebral ischemia is neurological deterioration related to ischemia that persists for 1 hour and has no other cause. Vasospasm is arterial narrowing demonstrated on angiography or Doppler with associated signs and symptoms. Vasospasm is relatively common and incidence peaks at about 4 to 10 days post subarachnoid hemorrhage. Patients with large subarachnoid blood load and smokers are at an increased risk. Prophylactic nimodipine has been shown to reduce delayed cerebral ischemia and is started at the time of diagnosis and continued for 21 days. Diagnosis of vasospasm can be challenging. Clinical signs can include a drop in GCS or new focal neurology, but while DCI occurs in up to 70% of patients, it only causes symptoms in about 30%. The gold standard investigation is subtraction angiography, but this is rarely performed. CT angiogram may be done, as well as intracranial Doppler. Traditional Triple H therapy is controversial. Management includes hypertension and targeting euvolemia. Nimodipine may be administered intraarterially during angiography, and balloon angioplasty is also an option. Other proposed treatments have included magnesium and statins, but trial evidence does not support their routine use.
What non-neurological complications might occur?
Non-neurological complications can be divided into body systems. Respiratory complications include neurogenic pulmonary edema, aspiration pneumonitis, and ARDS. Some cardiovascular complications are neurogenic stunned myocardium syndrome, which may include ECG changes, arrhythmias, and transient LV dysfunction, and more rarely, Takotsubo's cardiomyopathy. Metabolic complications are fever, hyperglycemia, and disorders of salt and water balance, such as SIADH, cranial DI, or cerebral salt wasting syndrome. Venous thromboembolism is another important complication.